Thank you, Matthew. And a very good morning to all today. Thanks for being with us. The title, as Matthew has mentioned in prayer there, for our message is Eyes Fixed on Jesus. And it's our concluding message in this short series on the Christian life of faith from the book of Hebrews. The New Testament frequently uses contest images to help us understand the Christian life of faith. For example, the life of faith is described as a war. We are called to endure hardship as good soldiers. The Christian life is described as a wrestling match or as a boxing match. Paul says, I fight not as one who beats the air. And all these contest images provide insights into different aspects of the struggle of the Christian life. But there is one contest image that appears repeatedly in the New Testament, and that is the image of an athlete running a race, a marathon race. The Christian life is described as a race in at least half a dozen passages within the New Testament, including the passage we are about to read today. Now, like the other images, the image of the race, especially a marathon race, reminds us that the Christian life is hard and demanding. It demands ruthless self-discipline, resilience, and single-minded focus. And it is these three qualities, self-discipline, resilience, and single-minded focus, which are precisely the characteristics that the writer promotes in our text for this morning. Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 12 then, and we will read from verses 1 to 6. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 to 6. I've forgotten to find the number for the Pew Bible. Forgive me for that. 1210, thank you. That's 1210 in the Pew Bible. Let's read together from God's Word. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. And let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. And you have forgotten the word of encouragement that addresses you as sons. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline. And do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes everyone he accepts as a son. We will see the first of these three characteristics then, immediately in verse 1. We are to run the Christian race by rigorous self-discipline. The text puts it like this. Let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. A runner who is serious strips off everything that hinders. Excess clothing, even excess body weight. Success depends on getting rid of everything that slows him down or diverts his energy. Athletes actually sometimes train carrying heavy packs on their backs to build up strength and energy against the time for the actual race when they will set these weights aside. I know someone who does that. I can just about keep up with him when he's got 20 kilos on his back. But when it comes to the race, not only these weights, but every other weighing hindrance is stripped off. Ruthless self-discipline that gets rid of everything that holds back in the race is the key to athletic triumph. And it is the key to Christian triumph as well. First, verse 1 says, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily entangles. Now, weights in the Christian life are things that are not necessarily in themselves sinful, but they can hold us back. They are things that absorb and divert energy, which would be better served in the race itself. It may be a variety of things. It may be our possessions. It may be hours frittered away in front of Sky TV, or endless hours on computer games. It may be our hobby, maybe our sport, maybe a relationship, maybe our family. We could be so involved in running our families all over the place, almost every day of the week, that we and they have no energy left for collective worship because we have run ourselves ragged. It may be our social networking sites that can absorb endless hours. I realize that some of these things, of course, may be of value and could, in actual fact, be used for gospel purposes. On the other hand, they could be a waste of time and energy. And so the point is, we need to analyze for ourselves their help and value in our Christian lives. It's not just a case of asking, well, what's wrong with this or that? Or is it permissible? Paul says all things are permissible, but not all things are helpful. We must ask, is this activity of mine a help or a hindrance? Do these activities refresh me in the life of faith, or do they distract me in the life of faith? Do they enable commitment to Christ, or do they cool my heart to Christ? And so we have to ask these questions honestly and with some urgency, for those that last the pace and receive the reward of everlasting life are those who have judged what are weights in their lives and discarded them before these weights stifle their running for Jesus. Notice too, we are to shed sin, sin that so easily entangles or overtakes. The Hebrew writer is a realist. Christians are always susceptible to sin. Make no mistake about it. Sin is always at hand, ready to pull us down or pull us off the track or stop us running. This is a real contest. We are always struggling with a sinful nature. Paul says to the Romans, when I want to do good, evil is right there with me. So whatever we know to be sinful and wrong in our lives, we must rid ourselves of. The chief sin of the Hebrew Christians was that they were in the danger of unbelief. They were facing very real adversity and suffering, and they were struggling to accept their situation in life. Just like the children of Israel in their struggles, they were in danger then of the sin of murmuring and complaining against God. And complaining was ready to degenerate into bitterness. Now, we could be embittered towards God by our circumstances because of our problems, problems that we face. For example, problems in our job, or problems of not having a job, or because of the difficulties in our marriage, or the difficulties of not being married, or because of our children give us trouble, or because we don't have children to give us trouble. It might even be that we are dissatisfied with church or our lot in church. We wish God had put us in a different church, in different situations. We're all tempted in these ways to complain about our circumstances. And we could allow these things to destroy us and destroy our faith by the unspoken accusation that it's all God's fault. These are deadly, faith-destroying sins. They can easily make us casualties in the Christian life, hamstring us in the Christian race, Nursing these kind of resentments makes some abandon the race altogether. And so we must throw off all temptations to self-pity. We must trust God that He knows best. Now, I'm not suggesting for one moment that it's always easy to trust God. But it's always the answer to trust God. His ways are perfect. And that doesn't mean, of course, that we shouldn't ask God or plead with God to intervene in our difficulties. Matthew has been reminding us of some who have been through extreme difficulties, particularly this week and over the weeks and months beforehand. And you know, it is right to bring these difficulties and problems and concerns to God and ask Him to change the situation and intervene in the situation. But it's not right to be angry with God if He does not remove these difficulties and problems. Hebrews 12 verse 1 then is a command to look at our life. Think hard about our activities and our attitudes which might hinder us, and get ruthless about what stays and what goes. Runners don't enter a race intending just to meander along. They run to win the prize with total commitment. You know, that brings us to our second point, which I would like to notice. The second of these three qualities, these three characteristics required in the Christian marathon. We are to run with perseverance, with endurance, with resilience. Again, we find this in verse 1. Let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Now, of course, this command does not just come out of the blue. This, in fact, is the point stressed throughout the whole book of Hebrews. The Hebrew believers are encouraged to endure, to persevere, to run, to fight, to be alert, be strengthened, avoid drift, avoid neglect, don't be sluggish. They are constantly urged to keep going, to run with perseverance the race marked out for us. The Christian race is a long distance race. It's an endurance race. It's a bit like a marathon or a series of marathons. Paula Radcliffe is a great British marathon runner. Some of you will recall when she couldn't finish the marathon in the Olympics in Athens due to stomach problems. She was utterly distraught, exhausted and emotionally drained. She has openly admitted that Athens was the worst moment of her career. However, less than 3 months after Athens, she entered the New York Marathon. Now, many were apprehensive over Paula's decision to run in the New York Marathon, thinking that it may end in further disappointment or further injury. And with the starting list shaping up to be one of the greatest female fields ever assembled, even the most diehard Paula fans would have had some doubts over how she would fare in the race. Now, as it happened with one of the most nail-biting of finishes and exciting finishes ever witnessed in marathon history, Paula won the New York Marathon by 4 seconds. Perseverance and focus had kept her going. Now, the Christian life is like that. It's a long-distance race which lasts the entire Christian lifetime. It's certainly not a short sprint. It requires a sustained kind of running. There will always be obstacles. There will always be problems. We will get weary. We will get distraught. We will be emotionally drained and exhausted at times. But we must endure to finish the race with joy. It's that steady, persistent, enduring attitude that keeps going and refuses to be deflected that finally wins the prize. Now, these Hebrew Christians had started off well. They had taken their stand with Jesus. They had believed in Christ. They had even heard from the apostles directly. Chapter 2 says they had seen miracles, signs, and wonders to confirm the word. They were thrilled about what they had been involved in the founding of the church. And they had started off running, but they hit an obstacle. And that obstacle was persecution. And when that began, they stopped running. In fact, they started to go backwards. They were growing careless, spiritually lazy and negligent. And that's why the writer is saying we must run the race with endurance. The key words for the Hebrew Christians are patient endurance. We can't just walk off our lane and sit down. We can't just fall apart at the first obstacle. Now, we should be encouraged by that because we can be like that at times. We can stop running and we can start to go backwards in the Christian life. But we're not out of the race. Unlike a normal race, you see, the Christian race doesn't only belong to the strong. In the race, Christians don't have the ability by themselves to overcome obstacles. How could these Hebrew Christians possibly continue in the face of the most severe opposition? There will be times when we feel, how can we possibly continue? What could possibly strengthen and motivate them? What could energize and enthuse them? What could get them back in the Christian race and enable them to run as they once did? The only way they could do that was by fixing their eyes on Jesus. What is our main motivation in the race? Jesus is. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus. So as well as self-discipline and perseverance, we need single-minded focus on Jesus. Verse 2 says, let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. He is the supreme exponent of faith. If you want to know what faith looks like, look at Jesus. Now, the lives of many Old Testament people of faith are there to inspire us, but none inspires us, engages us like Jesus, because he shows us faultlessly and fully what faith involves. Yes, we can be encouraged by others. Verse 1 tells us that others will motivate us. Since we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, let us run. These are examples of ordinary people who did extraordinary things by faith. But none of these inspirational figures, nor any inspirational figures in the church, is a real focus. Now, we live in a culture where we like to make celebrities and heroes. You may have been watching that recent series on STV, The Greatest Scot of All Time. And there you have a 35-strong list from the world of the arts and entertainment, science and business and sport. And the Scot from that list who is judged to be the greatest will be commemorated in a public piece of art. Now, that's not what the Christian race is about. And that's not what church is about. Christians are not competing with each other to be the greatest or the best respected. Unlike a normal race, the prize is not for the fastest or the strongest or the greatest. You know, when the disciples argued about who should be the greatest, Jesus said, whoever is the least is the greatest. But having said that, we are encouraged, are we not, by thousands who have gone before, who have endured the opposition of the world, and who have finished the race by faith, and surround us by a great cloud of witnesses who say, it can be done. By faith, it can be done. We are encouraged by those in the church who inspire and motivate us. But we shouldn't be concentrating on them. None of those inspirational figures are our real focus. They are flawed. They will let us down. Our real focus is Jesus. There is only one champion, and that is Jesus. He is the supreme example of how the race is to be run, the perfecter of faith. In him, faith has reached its perfection. He embodies, as no other does, steadfast faith that scorns all ill in the present for the reward of the future. Verse 2 says, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame. And so the key to enduring is engaging with Jesus. He has taken faith to limits never before known. And just as a runner concentrates on the finishing line, so we should be concentrating on Jesus. That's why we come to church after all, is it not? Church services are God's means of grace. They focus us on Jesus. They feed us on Jesus. That's why it's so sad if we allow our concentration while here to be deflected to other things. We don't come to church to focus on chairmen or children or chairs or church buildings or preachers or musicians or technology or any of these relatively minor things. The only excellence that should really absorb us is the excellence of Jesus. We look at Him and we know that however difficult it may be to continue running, to continue competing, to continue swimming against the tide of this world, it can be done. By faith, it can be done. How did Jesus endure the cross? How did Jesus continue? How did Jesus scorn the scorn? What carried Jesus through the taunting, the scourging, the crucifying, and even more bitter rejection and desertion and abandonment by God Himself? It was faith, sheer faith in the joy and the glory that lay ahead. He believed that his obedience to his Father's will would result in indescribable glory, indescribable joy. And he was right. God turned the shame of the cross upside down by exalting him from the lowest place to the very highest pinnacle in heaven, seated forever at the right hand of God Himself. So if it seems today that there are going to be some temporary losses when you run this race with Jesus, you're right. That is why Jesus said to count the cost before you sign on. But the marathon of the Christian life is not mainly loss. It's mainly gain. For the joy that was set before Him, He endured the cross. It's only a matter of timing. Faith sees joy as a matter of timing. We need to be truthful about what's involved in the Christian life, because plenty of people seem to start the race and then fall away. You know, that's what happened to these Christian believers. That's why this letter was written. Many Jewish people who had been intellectually convinced about the Christian faith, had professed to be Christians, had gone back when the opposition and trials came. They had shrunk back. They went back to Judaism. They denied Jesus. I want to tell you today, if you decide to follow Jesus, you're following someone who endured the cross, who was crucified. You're choosing misunderstanding, misrepresentation, opposition. You will be an outsider. Are you up for this? Well, of course, none of us by ourselves are or could be. We can only embrace and live the Christian life by fixing our eyes on Jesus. The Christian life only begins by looking to Jesus for salvation. For you see, Jesus is not only the supreme example of faith, the perfecter of faith in that sense, He is also the author of faith. He is the supreme object for faith. Hebrews 2:10 says He is the author of salvation. Without Jesus, we are lost. We are on the road to nowhere. The race we are on is not the race to heaven, but the race to hell. And we won't escape ruin and destruction by faith in ourselves or our own goodness or our own moral integrity or church attendance or prayers or good works. We won't be saved by faith in religion or church or spiritual experiences. Salvation is found in Jesus alone. We must look to him. He is the sacrifice for our sins that averts God's judgment and brings the forgiveness of sins. He is the priest seated at the right hand of God who has overcome all enemies and knows how to give us strength and wisdom in the Christian race. He is the ruler of the universe who ensures that we are never tempted beyond that which is for our eternal good. The gospel call for you today, if you do not know Jesus, is to trust him, to look to him, to bow to him, to believe in him. We've thought about how Jesus endured the cross. Why did Jesus endure the cross? That those who trust in him might be saved. The cross is a place of sacrifice for sins. The cross is a place of substitution, a place where Jesus takes the place of the sinner. Peter says Christ died for sins once for all. The righteous in the place of the unrighteous to bring us to God. So if you haven't yet placed your faith in Jesus, then do so today. Accept his sacrifice on your behalf and be saved. Fix your eyes on Jesus for salvation. Leave the race to hell and start for heaven. It might be a hard race, but its outcome is eternal joy. And so the Christian race requires discipline, self-discipline. Even discipline and training from God himself. Verse 6 tells us that. Every son that the Father loves, he disciplines, he trains. All these difficulties we face in life, which we thought of earlier, loneliness, unemployment, relationship difficulties, loss, grief, opposition, persecution. They are the training and disciplining regime of our Father. They are for our eternal good. He has one great goal in view, that we might finish the race with triumph, that we might win the prize, that we might run the race. His chief goal is our future. And true faith always and ever looks to the future. His chief joy, the joy that was set before him, is that we should be with him, to share with him in that joy, that future of indescribable joy, of indescribable glory with Jesus. We sung earlier today, Matthew gave out that hymn of 100 or so years old. We've not sung for 30 years. Christ is the way, and Christ the prize. Therefore, let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its scorn, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary.